You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Parachesa Kakpour won a California Book Award for her first novel, Suns and Other Flammable Objects, which dealt with an Iranian family coming to grips with the aftermath of 9/11. Her latest called The Last Illusion is quite different. It mixes folklore and magical fiction to create a captivating story of a mysterious boy's journey into the civilized world. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Parachesa Kakpour to our show today. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
How much of this story did you take from Persian folklore?
It's actually based on the story from the Book of Kings. It's a small portion of that text, and it's
that's the Shahnameh.
The Shahnameh, exactly. And basically, in that version, you have a feral child who essentially just is raised by a giant mythical bird in the wilderness, and then later he comes back to Iran and becomes a great warrior. And that story always fascinated me.
Did you grow up listening to stories like that?
Yeah, my father would tell me stories from the Shahnameh when I was a young immigrant to this country, and that story in particular really resonated.
Do you think that they are still told in Iran in the after the Islamic Revolution?
Absolutely. It's definitely the national epic of Iran and has always been, and you can't find an Iranian who doesn't know several stories from it, and usually they can recite it.
It's also an important work for Zoroastrians.
Yeah, and, you know, my father had a great interest in Zoroastrians. Actually, my name, Parachesa, comes from the Zoroastrian. It's the daughter of Zarathustra. And, we weren't born into Zoroastrianism, but my dad had a huge interest. And so with Zoroastrians, you always have a lot of real fervent Persian pride.
Well, it has been said to understand Iranian culture, you have to understand Zoroastrianism, even though most people are not members of the, what is it, the Farsis.
The Parsis in India. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The main character in your book, Zal, grows up as a feral child. His home is a cage, and he is surrounded by birds. Now, in the original plot, the birds even play more of a role than you have it because you're adapting this to modern life.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted it to have those magical roots, but I really wanted to literalize or actualize the magic in it, and I wanted a story that had some sort of universal resonance. So most of it is about him coming of age as a human, as a man.
Why do you think feral children have been a favorite topic going back many centuries?
I think we're actually always really mystified by the idea of being, you know, brought to life by a different being. And I think the interesting thing is with feral children, we still think so many of those stories are hoaxes, and there's no real way to tell which was real and which isn't. So it kind of, I think, taps into this weird human fantasy of what if we came of being by another species.
If we didn't have the nurture, if we just had the nature.
Exactly, yeah.
Zal's mother views him with disgust when he's born. What about him makes her recoil in the way that she does?
What fascinated me in the Shahnameh was that they describe him like an albino when he was born, and the whiteness of his skin and the whiteness of his hair causes this, like, huge aversion to their child. And that fascinated me when I was an immigrant here, and everyone was, like, blonde-haired and pale-skinned, and I thought of Western notions of beauty. And then I thought, how bizarre, then the Shahnameh, everything was all about black hair, brown skin, and that was beauty. And this child was essentially only cast aside because of his whiteness.
Although in the Shahnameh, there would have been no awareness of psychological instability. But you can write about that
right.
in the case of Zal's mother.
Yeah.
And she refuses to name her child. And then why put him in a birdcage?
Well, she has this obsession with birds. She has this aviary right outside of her house, and there she has tons of birds that she regards as her children, and she actually loves them quite a lot. And this final child of hers, born quite late, she's fairly old at that age, she has no use for. So she
calls him her white demon.
Yeah. And that interested me, too, again, going back to the whiteness of skin causing a problem. And I have her in the moment of the revolution in Iran, which hasn't quite hit her village, but the idea of unrest is there, which later I hope that kind of mirrors the idea of unrest in the U.S. between Y2K to 9/11.
When he's 10, Zal is taken in by a man named Anthony Hendricks, who's a behavioral psychologist. And I'm assuming that to some degree this was you thinking about your experience as an immigrant, suddenly having to learn a new language. In Zal's case, of course, a language in general.
Yeah, it really, his struggle to me was quite autobiographical. I mean, my father was reading me the stories from the Shahnameh when I was learning English. And I had terrible insomnia when I was in elementary school. And much of it came from this horror of recess at school and having to really hustle to pick up English words. And usually I would pick up derisive words and I would come home.
So you knew all the curse words first.
Yeah, I knew all the curse words first. I mean, I still curse quite a lot. I sometimes wonder if I have an ear for that especially.
And you grew up in Southern California. Was there already a sizable Iranian community there at the time? And was it anything like what we see on the TV series, the Shahs of Sunset?
Yeah, well, you know, the portmanteau, Tarangelis, is definitely earned. That was about 35 minutes from my home. I grew up in Pasadena. But during the weekends, my parents would go for, like, Persian food or just to show us that there was a community there. But what was interesting was we were still outsiders there, mainly socioeconomically, and there were no Iranians in my school.
How did you get interested in writing?
It's really all I've ever been interested in. At the age of 4, I knew that I wanted to write books, and that came from the experience of leaving during the revolution and just having books and paper and pen, and storytelling became a means of survival. So for me, it was both recreation, but it was like the only purpose I could see to living. It was a way to deal with life, and so I've never wanted to be anything else.
Was Suns and Other Flammable Objects your first published work?
Yeah, and it was also my first novel, too. I never had written a novel before that, though I guess...
You had written short stories?
I had written some short stories, and to be honest, you know, in elementary school through high school, I wrote a lot of novels. I was very invested in being a writer at a really young age, but... that was my first serious attempt.
That book is semi-autobiographical.
Yes.
And then at first glance, this book is not semi-autobiographical. And yet you point out that there are all sorts of parallels here as well.
Yeah, one of my good friends actually said that this book feels like a memoir for me. And it actually feels the most close to me, even more close to me than the first book. So... I relate to almost all the characters very deeply. This book really, a lot of my own neuroses and a lot of my beliefs are in here wholly.
You have an illusionist in here as well, yeah. Inspired by a real situation?
Yes, by David Copperfield, specifically because of his 1983 Statue of Liberty Disappearing Act, which was one of the first live telecasts I ever saw in the U.S. at the age of 5.
You mentioned that the whole idea of beauty becomes—it was really fascinating to you, and it plays a big role in this book. Zal is enamored when he first meets a girl, Asiya, but he's even more taken by her morbidly obese, bedridden sister, Willa.
Yeah, that character of Willa became kind of the love of my life. It's still, to me, the most beautiful character I've ever written, and there's a way in which that she operates like a great bird mother. Her abundance kind of becomes like that giant mythical Persian bird. But in other ways, she seems grounded and not, you know, neurotic and frenzied like her sister. She becomes the sort of opposite to her.
Well, her sister is anorexic.
Yeah.
You link Willa's backstory to the tale of Scheherazade, which is another Persian book.
Yeah, there's a lot of tucked in Persian stories in this. And then there's also like a lot of 9/11 and post 9/11 paraphernalia kind of scattered throughout this book. Because I wanted the book to have that sort of texture and ambiance of its actual substance, for the style to also be there as well.
It's been 7 years between the first book and this one. Did it take all that time to write this, or were you occupied with other things?
I was definitely occupied with teaching and also writing a lot of personal essays, mostly for the New York Times, but actually it took over 2 years to sell this book. It was very, very difficult, whereas the first book only took a few months. We were done with this years ago.
You wrote a piece in the New York Times on the 9th anniversary of 9/11. The headline was, My 9 Years as a Middle Eastern American. What did you mean by Middle Eastern American rather than an Iranian American?
Well, because 9/11 wasn't really an Iranian issue, but it forced a lot of us into a sort of pan-Middle Eastern identity where suddenly, even though I was not Muslim, I felt a need to defend Muslim culture. And so the unfortunate circumstances kind of created this sort of solidarity between these otherwise unrelated countries, countries that are often even enemies of each other.
You're not a Muslim?
No, I'm not. Historically, my family was Muslim, but my parents were fairly agnostic and maybe even atheistic, you could say.
You wrote those early novels and then never published them?
As a child, you mean?
Yeah.
I mean,
what kinds of stories were they?
They were all very magical and fantastic, and I think it came from things like the Persian Book of Kings. And to me, like domestic realism, I was never interested in it. And in fact, that's my first novel, and here I see this as more of a homecoming to what I was always interested in.
Have you gone back to Tehran?
No, I've never gone back. It seems
How old were you when you left?
About 3.5, 4.
You would have no memories, really.
Yeah, but though I'd really like to go, it just seems like there's never a great time. There's always, you know, some circumstance that makes it very difficult, especially when I have a profile as a journalist as well as an author. It's tricky.
Because it might very well put you into make them suspicious of you when you go there.
Yeah, though I found out recently that I'm on the Iranian government's virtual embassy website as an Iranian they're proud of, so maybe I will be able to go sooner rather than later. I don't know.
Are we going to have to wait another 7 years for the next one?
Oh, gosh, I hope not. No, I'm halfway through a third novel, and I have a fourth book as well, so I'm hoping that they will be out sooner rather than later.
Meanwhile, we have this book just out from Bloomsbury, Parachisa Kakpour's The Last Illusion. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you so much for having me.